Aquifers and watersheds. Understanding our water resources. A production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Episode 1. Groundwater, soil, and Dr. Dirt. Water above and water below. Water in all its various forms surrounds us, and it is essential for life as we know it to exist. The circulation of water through our biosphere, evaporating from liquid, condensing, precipitating, and ultimately returning to its liquid state, is known as the hydrological cycle. Most of us got a grasp of this hydrological cycle in high school. However, the professional study of water is known as hydrology. The dictionary defines hydrology as the scientific study of the properties, distribution, and effects of water on the Earth's surface, in the soil and underlying rocks, and in the atmosphere. Not surprisingly, there are now a myriad of scientific specializations that have evolved within the broad parameters of this field, as our understanding of our water resources and our need to protect and preserve them has grown. This ever-expanding body of knowledge can present a challenge for non-specialists who are trying to keep up, though, particularly those whose geographical training was either minimal or part of a distant and now fuzzy class in school. And that's the premise for this series. Using the state of Wisconsin as an example, conveniently, I happen to be standing on it, I intend to guide you through all the basic concepts and terminology you'll need to sharpen and refine your own understanding of two fundamental components of the physical geography of water, aquifers and watersheds. We'll leave lakes, oceans, and the global atmospheric system for another day. After all, this is a podcast series and not an audio epic. I will, however, introduce you to a number of dedicated specialists working within Wisconsin's aquifers and watersheds who are grappling with water resource issues of particular concern, and try to give you an idea of the scope and impact of their labors. And most of all, I'll try to keep it entertaining, because learning should be fun. Okay, let's go. Perhaps like me, your curiosity about the icy waters underground was first stoked by early Pink Floyd records. Or perhaps it was in your first poetry class, reading Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Kubla Khan.
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea.
In both cases, the artists are striving to evoke a sense of wonder, and I would argue that it is that very sense of wonder that drives the efforts of the very best scientists and artists. As it turns out, there really are quite a few underground rivers throughout the world, occurring naturally in cave systems, or, as has frequently happened in recent centuries, entombed underneath today's mega metropolises. Still, the vast majority of underground water is found in aquifers. About 25% of the world's total freshwater supply is contained within the lithosphere in what we call groundwater. Lithosphere being a $20 geography word for the ground. Interestingly, the recent confirmation of vast reserves of fresh groundwater on offshore continental shelves may cause that particular number to be revised upward. To see how this all plays out, it's time to follow the raindrop. Rain may fall to the ground, but water never stops. Some of this water may flow along the land surface into streams or lakes, and some may get absorbed by plants. Some water quickly evaporates and returns to the atmosphere, and some of this water seeps underground. The flow of water into the ground through the pores and openings of the soil is called infiltration. To understand how water works through the soil to reach an aquifer, I wanted to get a specialist to help explain the process. So I headed up to Lodi to speak with the best soil scientist I know, Dr. Fred Madison from the University of Wisconsin, Madison. As I pulled into Fred's driveway, I noticed that the plates on his pickup truck read, Dr. Dirt.
Well, I am here with Dr. Fred Madison. We're out in the wilds of Wisconsin in his fabulous and cozy cottage out here near Lodi. I'm talking with him and his dog, Chloe, a very insistent and happy golden Labrador. I thought I'd ask him about what really happens with water when it gets into that upper zone, what they call, I guess, the vadose zone or aeration zone. What really happens? What's important for people to know? And also, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I think this is an appropriate topic. It's very interesting to follow the course of rainwater as it moves into the soil, which has already been suggested to you is called infiltration. And then as it moves through the soil, again, part of the vadose zone in a process called percolation, down to the point where all of the pores are filled with water and we're in the saturated zone. But let's go back and look at the vadose zone for a moment. Lots of things happen with this water as it gets into the soil. First of all, it's important that we get it in and get it in properly. So we need to maintain good soil structure in the surface of the soil that will allow that water to infiltrate, to get into the soil. Once it's in the soil, it's going to do a whole bunch of things for us. First and foremost, it is going to provide water for trees, lawns, shrubs, forbs, whatever you have growing, they get their water from the soil. In Wisconsin, normally we have about 30 inches of precipitation a year. Of that 30 inches, 20 inches roughly is used for evaporation and transpiration, which is basically plant growth. And then the balance 10 inches or so percolates on down through the soil and recharges our groundwater system. And ultimately, because groundwater discharges to surface water, it ends up in our rivers and lakes. So let's look a little more closely at what goes on in that vadose zone. First of all, the water comes in and it can accumulate. The soil has the ability to accumulate a fair amount of moisture in the pores that exist in the soil and in the structural features and whatever. That water can accumulate to a point probably really in excess a little bit of what the soil should hold, but that water will respond to gravity and will ultimately move on down through the soil, leaving behind a certain amount of moisture that was attached to soil particles. This is the moisture that the plants use for their growth. The other things that happen as the waters move through the soil, we rely on the soil to treat water, to take out contaminants, and either to convert those contaminants to forms that can be used by plants, or simply to alter their form to something that's not harmful to the environment. So in a sort of a funny way, the soil acts as a sewage treatment facility for for water that's coming in. And if it happens to be laden with contaminants, the soil does a very efficient job of removing those contaminants, thus providing some protection for the groundwater system. These processes of changing contaminants rely on water moving through the soil at a reasonable rate. In soils that are very fine textured, clays, for example, because the pores are so small and are not particularly well connected, water tends to move very slowly, and in some instances, actually too slowly, and we end up with soils that are saturated for longer than they should be. In many of our soils in Wisconsin, fortunately, we have a very nice soil cover of windblown materials left over after the last ice sheet went away that aggregate themselves into really a very, very nice unit for water to move through and have a whole bunch of contact with soil particles. The secret of this business of contaminant change and contaminant removal is the contact that the percolating water has with soil particles. That's a very critical part of it.
Geoscientists have a great word for that windblown silt that Fred is talking about, though they can't agree on how to say it. It's spelled L-O-E-S-S, and it's alternately pronounced less, low-s, or more like the German root lus. Whatever the case may be, it's still a great Scrabble word. Geoscience has lots of great Scrabble words. Since it's a global effort, there's usually an alternate word for just about every geological phenomenon borrowed from some language or another, like Aeolian for windblown, spelled
A-E-O-L-I-A-N. 7 letters, 5 vowels, that'll get you out of a Scrabble scrape. An aquifer, that has 7 letters, 4 vowels, and the Q. You'll win the game with that one. Anyway, back to Fred and other types of soils.
Our so-called medium-textured soils do a very good job of slowing that water movement down but not stopping it. The water can move through, but it has lots of contact with soil particles. That's positive. In our very coarse-textured soils, sands and other related soils, of which we have a fair amount in Wisconsin, the pore sizes are larger and water movement is really very rapid. The water in sandy soils does not do as good a job of contaminant removal as we would like. And that's critical.
I don't know that most people think about soil as having pores. Is there an easy way to visualize that or think about that?
Sure. Pores or avenues for water movement in soils are created two ways. One, if you just take a pile of sand, pile it up and take a look at it, the sand grains will fit together, but there will be pore spaces between almost all of them. That's just the space between the mineral grains, the naturally occurring space. It's a very important part of it, particularly in coarser textured soils. As we move to more fine textured soils, because of the varying pore sizes, the pores between the grains will fill up very quickly. Water does not move as rapidly through that mechanism. However, a secondary process happens in those medium textured soils, and that is that the soil particles themselves aggregate and form structural units. And the spacing between the structural units also offer excellent avenues for water movement. So the ideal combination of a medium textured soil that's well structured and has lots of ways for water to move, that's the perfect soil. We got a lot of those in Wisconsin. We're very fortunate. But I think that's the important thing about pores in soils. Two kinds, again, the natural space between the grains as they exist, and then the grains aggregating themselves and there being places between the structural units for water to move.
Is that physical structure, or is that on a molecular level? Or
physical. Physical structure. We have scientific terms that we use to describe it. The soil surface structure, for example, is often called granular, which means that they're rounded aggregates of soil particles. We used to use a lot of wonderful names. We used to call it nuciform, which means nut-like. There are a variety of words that have been applied to it. As we move into the lower parts of the soil itself, we find that the structures tend to get more blocky in shape and look exactly like blocks. They are blocks. And again, the water can move along those faces between the blocks. So then there's some secondary structures that also evolve. But there are lots of things that the soil tries to do to enhance its ability to percolate waters effectively. And forming structure is one of those.
This water, it percolates down. I love that word. And you can hear percolating coffee in the background because, well, that's because I like coffee. What happens to this water if it doesn't get absorbed by plants?
Again, back to the numbers that we used before. We need, for our plants to grow and for there to be effective evaporation at the soil surface, we need 20 inches of rain a year. That leaves us 10 or so more that are then left. They can move through the soil. They will ultimately work their way down through the rest of the vadose zone. Perhaps this is a distinction we didn't really make clear at the beginning of this. The thing that we call soil, as soil scientist, is probably in Wisconsin about the top meter or so of the materials at the surface of the earth. Once we get out of those materials that have been affected by soil forming processes, we get into unconsolidated materials that are not saturated. That's the lower part of the vadose zone. The business end of all of this process is in the soil. That's where the microbial activity lives, and the microbes are the ones that do all of the contaminant breakdown and transformation and stuff like that. That's a very important part of it. But what it says is that if we can effectively capture all of the rainfall that falls on the land, and it doesn't run off and just flood for us in the rainstorm, we're going to put about 10 inches of water a year through it that the soils will purify for us and that will work its way down to the groundwater system ultimately. Now, that path is a wonderful word that we use to describe the movement of water through soil. We describe it as tortuosity, which means that a drop of water doesn't just go right straight down and end up in the groundwater. It may wiggle and waggle around in the soil depending upon things that could impede flow. In some places, downward flow may be stopped for a while and the water will move laterally until it can find a place to get down. But basically, water is responding to gravity and it wants to get down through the soil. In the broadest sense, that's the process. But the path that it takes can be circuitous and complicated, but it doesn't matter particularly. The key point in terms of water use and water purification is that we take the rainwater that falls on the soil, infiltrate it into the soil, and then allow it to percolate down. We don't want to have any runoff. We want to get the full 30 inches that we get this year. We're almost over 40. We want to get that all into the soil. Then we can recharge our groundwater. We can refill the lakes and streams. We can do all kinds of good stuff if that happens.
Is there a limit on how much water a particular area can absorb?
Almost all soils have a capacity that's maximum. For a soil to function efficiently, it has to be a combination of three parts. You have to have the mineral matter, you have to have water, and you have to have air. If the water is obviously in the pores between the mineral grains, and if all those pores are full, then the air is gone from the soil, and that's not going to be conducive to plant growth or anything else. Fortunately, even though the pores get filled, the pores can get filled if we have a lot of rain over a relatively short period of time. But then as the rain stops, that's time for the water again responding to gravity to move on down through the soil and get out of Dodge, as the saying goes. We can go on from there. But it's very important to see that those pathways are kept open as much as we can. Just for the fun of it, if you drive around sometimes in Wisconsin in the spring of the year when the corn is starting to grow, May or June, and you see maybe a little depression in a field and it's been raining a lot, you notice that that corn is very yellow in that low spot. The reason that it's yellow is because the pores are full of water, and that creates conditions without oxygen. And under those circumstances, nitrogen, which is vital for making corn green, disappears into the atmosphere. You can see those nitrogen deficiencies very quickly in a period when there's a lot of rainfall. That's exactly what it is. It's just too much water.
That's very interesting. And is there a counterpoint to this? I've heard some people talk about a wilting point in soil.
Well, the wilting point is the other way, of course. That's when the soils are so dry that there is not moisture available for the plants. Last summer in July and August, we had a pretty dry spell. We had a terrifically wet June, and then it really didn't rain for a couple of months. By the middle of August, as you're driving down the road, you could look at the same cornfields, which were a little taller than they were the first time you looked at them, but you could also see that the leaves were curled up, particularly in the late afternoon. That's the beginning of wilt. There is a point beyond which plants cannot take water from soils. If that water gets to that point, that's the wilting point.
After it gets through this vadose zone, now, okay, as a soil scientist, do you use aeration zone or vadose zone? What's your favorite term?
My favorite term is soil.
Are these $20 words here?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know, obviously, I'm familiar with the vadose zone terminology. I don't really use it. I talk about the soil, which is that top meter or so of materials on the top at the Earth's surface, because that's where you get the water into the soil, and that's where all of the business happens. Yeah. Most of the reactions, chemical reactions in soils, are driven by microbes. And the microbial population needs a carbon source for it to thrive and go. And that happens within that top meter. That's where the carbon sources are. That's really very, very important. Once you break out of the soil and get into what we call the soil parent material, which is unweathered material, you really have very little carbon, very little stuff for the microbes to eat. If the microbes don't have carbon to eat, they don't exist.
Four things that you got to have for soil: air, water, minerals, and microbes, bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
Organic life.
You betcha.
Well, to understand groundwater, you first need to learn about the ground and how water gets to aquifers. I felt Fred had got us there, but before I let him go, I wanted to know if he had any pressing concerns about our current uses of groundwater.
If a river or a stream gets contaminated, it's relatively easy to identify the source of the contaminants and then to do something about that source. Stop it, clean it up, whatever. We can do that. And the result of all of that is dramatic increases in surface water quality if you simply take away the source of stuff running into the water.
Water will clean itself up with natural processes fairly fast, at least on our timescale.
If nothing else, it just flushes it out with a good rainstorm. But on the other hand, stuff percolating down to the groundwater that carries contaminants with it, not much happens in the groundwater system. It's very difficult. If we push a lot of nitrates into a particular aquifer, they don't go away. They stay there. We really don't have the ability at this point to fix an aquifer if it gets contaminated. And I think that's a very serious concern, very, very serious, with chemicals and fertilizer and animal waste and all kinds of stuff. We put a lot of pressure on the soil to do a lot of treating for us. And in some places, we exceed that capacity, quite frankly. And that means that stuff's going to go to the groundwater system. And we don't know how to fix the groundwater system.
Not yet, at least.
No. Okay. Well, what do you think, Chloe?
Chloe's going to withhold judgment. All right, Fred. Well, UW's got a basketball game going on tonight that I think you want to catch, so I'm going to let you go. But thanks for taking time to talk to me about groundwater, soil moisture in the Vado Zone, and aquifers. Any final thoughts?
Well, I think that pretty well covers it. I would say two things about it. One is, it's a fascinating system to study. I've been a soil scientist for more years than I probably would admit, but I've never lost my interest in it, and it's fascinating. There are a whole bunch of fields that are all involved in all of this. Hydrogeology is incredibly fascinating. There's just a bunch of good stuff, and we need people. We need folks to come up and make up the workforce for the next 20 to 30 or 40 years. It's very, very important, because there's a lot of work to be done.
Yes, indeed. All right. Thank you so much. In the next podcast, we're going deeper down to the aquifers themselves, and I'm going to show you how you can find all the aquifers in your own area, wherever that may be. There's lots more to discover, and I do hope you join us. This is Chris Bocast. Till next time. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Thanks for listening.